From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Mueller report concerning the NFL's handling of the Ray Rice assault incident was released on Thursday. Ahead on Only a Game, a look at what the investigation found and what it may have missed. Also, Boston's bid for the 2024 Summer Olympics gains momentum. The latest Cooperstown electees talk about the honor, and the New York Knicks plummet to depths previously inhabited only by the Philadelphia 76ers. Also ahead, former pro goaltender Clint Malarchuk comes to terms with anxiety, depression, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and a horrific accident that triggered post-traumatic stress disorder.
I thought my purpose was to play in the NHL. After that, I thought my purpose was to coach in the NHL. Now I look and those were just stepping stones. Why was I given all these disorders? I feel my real purpose was to write the book and now to talk about it.
Stay tuned. The Broncos face the Colts in the NFL's divisional playoff round this weekend. That means the pride of Denver, Peyton Manning, will square off against the quarterback who sent him west, Andrew Luck. Joining me now is the Indianapolis Stars' Greg Doyle, who is in Denver for the game. Greg, welcome back.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Peyton Manning led the Colts to a Super Bowl win in 2007. He's a five-time MVP. He was, of course, much beloved in Indianapolis when the Colts let him walk after the 2011 season. Is that still the case?
Oh, yeah, yeah. One children's hospital in Indianapolis is called the Peyton Manning Children's Hospital. I mean, he's beloved for a lot of reasons. He came here, made the Colts great overnight. They built a downtown stadium for him, really, for him. And downtown Indy is thriving. And I think Peyton Manning had a big, big factor in that.
Since Indianapolis let Manning go in order to draft Luck, neither team has struggled. Manning and Denver reached the Super Bowl last year, and the Colts have been 11-5 in each of Luck's three seasons. So this matchup can't be personal for either quarterback, right?
No, I don't think it is. They like each other very much, as well they should. I mean, they're both nice guys. But it's kind of interesting, it's ironic, that Andrew Luck went to the Peyton Manning passing camp when Luck was in high school. The Mannings remembered him and liked him and all that. So these guys genuinely like each other. There's no rivalry. They understand. It's not a matter of who's better, who won the trade. They're both thrilled to be where they are, and they both get it.
A few weeks ago, we spoke to Kevin Clark of the Wall Street Journal. He had written a column about Andrew Luck and his tendency to compliment players who had sacked him while they were still on the field. You know, nice hit. Is Luck as quick to praise Peyton Manning?
Oh, yeah. We asked Luck about Peyton and the Broncos after the Colts beat the Bengals last week. And Peyton called him a stud. So he's a great, he says, it's not about me versus him or any of that stuff, but he's a stud. He's a great player, one of the greatest of all time. No, Luck is very, very flowering in his praise of Peyton Manning. How could you not be? But Luck's the real deal. I mean, he's that nice a guy. He really is.
In your column published on Thursday, you argued that something is wrong with Peyton Manning. You point to the final seven games of the regular season in which his yards per game are down by more than 60 compared to the start of the year. Touchdown passes down substantially as well. So what do you think the problem is?
Well, and it's pretty apparent. His efficiency is way down. Passer rating is down from 112 to 85. That's MVP level to Mark Sanchez level. It's a huge drop in efficiency. And seven games is a pretty good sample size. What's happening is he's 38 years old. And when you get older, the season wears on, your arm gets tired. Or he's throwing ducks, frankly, Bill. We're all in the press box, quack, quack. We're quacking when he throws the ball. It's just the ball's wobbling. Now, the brilliance of Peyton Manning is geometry. He can throw a duck slow, and if he puts it in a certain spot, no one else can catch it but his receiver. So he's still effective. But the arm strength is not there. Plus, one of his legs is hurting. He's banged up. He's good enough to win, but he's not the Peyton Manning we're used to seeing.
Andrew Luck has helped Indianapolis reach the playoffs in each of his three seasons, but has not been to a conference championship yet. Still, you wrote earlier this week, the Colts are a winner this year, even if they lose to Denver on Sunday. How's that?
They're not all that good. They're just not. We can all be disappointed if you're an Indianapolis Colts fan. They've milked what they could milk out of this season. I think it's reasonable to expect them to lose on the road at Denver. And the season is a success based on what they had. Now, going forward, the GM's got to do a better job of giving them more next year.
It sounds to me as if you're suggesting that it's Denver that will advance to the AFC title game.
Yeah, we've got a 17-game track record with the Colts. They beat bad teams. They beat mediocre teams. They have a decent chance of beating a good team at home. And when they go on the road against anybody with any talent at all, they lose. And they lose actually kind of bad. Now, the first Broncos game, they only lost by seven, but they were down 24-0. They got blown out on the road by Pittsburgh, blown out on the road by the Dallas Cowboys. I'm not sure they're going to get blown out at Denver, but based on what they've done, who they are is a team that loses to Denver this week, yes.
Greg Doyle is a columnist for the Indianapolis Star, and he joined me from Denver. Greg, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. Always a pleasure.
Former FBI Director Robert Mueller released his report on the NFL's handling of the Ray Rice case on Thursday. The 96-page document supports the league's claim that no one with the NFL, including Commissioner Roger Goodell, had seen the video from inside the casino elevator where Rice assaulted his then-fiancée last year. The video was eventually made public by the website TMZ, but in a column for Slate, Jeremy Stahl argues that the investigation misses the bigger picture. Jeremy Stahl joins me now. Let's start with what Robert Mueller did uncover. Which findings stand out for you?
So the main thing that the executive summary of the Mueller report focused on was this question of whether or not the league had access to a second videotape from inside the elevator at the Revel Casino that really showed how horrific the attack of Jhené Palmer was. It also looked at the extent to which the league should have known to investigate this further than they did. It finds that they didn't have access to the tape, but they should have been able to get access to the tape had they wanted to.
You wrote that the report ignores, quote, the extent to which Goodell and the league willfully tried not to discover any additional information about the assault in the hopes of protecting a star player and favored franchise, end quote. Is that something we'll ever find out?
I don't think we're going to see another investigation. Don Van Natta has done some excellent reporting for ESPN Outside the Lines that looked into this question. And what he found was that the Ravens lobbied extensively the NFL for a two-game suspension, which was what was initially handed out to Ray Rice. The Mueller report confirms one of the main findings of that Outside the Lines reporting, which was that Ravens officials knew what the Inside the Elevator report showed. A security official for the team had communication with an Atlantic City police officer who told him what was on that video. The league didn't follow up with the Ravens to find out what they knew, and the Ravens didn't volunteer that information.
The video of Rice dragging Jhené Palmer, who was unconscious, out of the elevator was made public much earlier than the footage of the actual punch. Shouldn't the hallway video have triggered an earlier, more in-depth investigation by the NFL?
That's absolutely true, and that is one of the stronger findings of the Mueller report, that once they had seen this outside the elevator video, which showed an unconscious Jhené Palmer being dragged by Ray Rice, they should have known how serious this incident was and should have known to investigate further than they did.
Jeremy, it's worth noting that for all of the attention given to the Rice case and the child abuse case against Adrian Peterson, there is no evidence to suggest that the NFL's popularity has been affected. Does any of this have any real impact on Roger Goodell's future as commissioner of the NFL?
Roger Goodell's future as commissioner of the NFL seems entirely dependent on the NFL's ability to make money, and the league owner's support of him rests completely on that. And in that regard, he has not been damaged this year.
Jeremy Stahl is a senior editor for Slate, and you can link to his column titled They Should Have Known Better at onlyagame.org. Jeremy, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
I am wicked excited, and Boston's wicked excited.
That is how John Fish, the head of Boston's 2024 Olympic campaign, summed up his pitch to the U.S. Olympic Committee. The USOC chose Boston over San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C. Whether the International Olympic Committee will rate Boston more deserving than the various other cities in other countries likely to submit bids remains to be seen. But Boston Mayor Marty Walsh has already begun making promises about future Olympic-related decisions.
I promise that this will be the most open and transparent and inclusive process in Olympic history.
Given how secretive, sketchy, and scandal-ridden former processes have been, Mayor Walsh may be on safe ground there. Joining me is Phil Hirsch, who covers the Olympics for the Chicago Tribune. Phil, was Boston, your hometown, by the way, a good choice?
It's an interesting choice. It was certainly not the expected choice. You know, a year ago, U.S. Olympic Committee officials were a little concerned about Boston's global recognition. I was a little bit surprised by the choice. Not stunned, but a little surprised.
Do you have a sense of why Boston was the choice?
Clearly, the major selling point, this was referred to by the U.S. Olympic Committee and by Boston officials in their Friday press conferences, was the role that the universities can play in the bid in terms of providing facilities. Essentially, you've meshed with the new IOC emphasis, or their stated emphasis anyway, on minimizing costs, because clearly some countries had let costs for staging the Olympic Games get out of hand, particularly costs for things that were not directly related to actually staging the games, including infrastructure, roads, train stations, and whatever.
Boston had never been a U.S. bidder for the Olympic Games, which means, of course, they had never lost a bid. You've reported that might work against this bid. How so?
The 1924 Olympics, which were in Paris, was the first time that there was actual voting to determine which city got the Olympic Games. And since then, there have only been three first-time bidders that have won the Olympic Games: Melbourne, Australia, 1956, Munich in 1972, and Atlanta in 1996. There is some feeling that people will become more familiar with you as time goes on. That doesn't necessarily mean that a first-time bidder can't win, because three have, but it has been a little bit harder for first-time bidders to win.
Boston has an organized lobby against hosting the Olympics. They sent a letter to the USOC protesting Boston as a choice. Do protests of groups like No Boston Olympics tend to sway the selection committee?
Well, the IOC does not want to give the Olympics to places where there will be such a high level of protest that it might affect games preparations, which is why they tend to love dictatorships. Beijing, Russia, which, you know, is technically not a dictatorship, but Mr. Putin runs that country with an iron hand, because dictatorships will do whatever you ask them to do. I think that the No Boston Olympics could be a force. The question will be, as polling goes on, and the IOC does its own polling, what kind of public opinion there is as the vote gets closer.
Finally, Phil, you work out of Chicago, the city that was embarrassed when it lost in the first round of voting for the 2016 Games. Do you have any sense as to whether a U.S. bid will be considered more seriously this time around?
Well, everybody, and again, IOC members eventually vote for this thing on a secret ballot. So they can say whatever they want between now and the day in Lima, Peru, when they're going to push that button to decide which city to vote for. The United States international relations with the IOC were at a low ebb during both the New York bid for 2012 and the Chicago bid for 2016. Some of it had to do with simple disapproval of U.S. government policies around the world, and some had to do with this ongoing revenue sharing problem. There has been a new contract written that is more favorable to the IOC. So those issues seem to have diminished. Juan Antonio Samaranch Jr., who's the son of the late IOC president, sent me an email on Friday referring to exactly that, that the climate is a lot better now for a U.S. bid.
Phil Hirsch of the Chicago Tribune has covered 17 Olympic Games. If the USOC has their way, he'll be here in Boston during the summer of 2024. Phil, thank you very much for joining me.
I hope I'm alive and well enough to be doing that. Thank you very much.
Ahead on Only a Game, former NHL goalie Clint Malarchuk's frank discussion of his multiple disorders and his recovery. But first, the Atlanta Hawks have been enjoying the best record in the NBA's Eastern Conference for the first time since 1997, with star player Josh Smith lost to free agency and an ownership group in turmoil. Not many people had high hopes for the Hawks this season. But TNT analyst David Aldridge says that Atlanta has been an untapped jewel in the league for years. David Aldridge, what did you mean when you wrote that?
NBA players love going to Atlanta. If you talk to them, Atlanta is one of their favorite cities for a number of different reasons, some of which may interest your audience and some of which may not. But a lot of people have homes there. And so that was always a city that I thought would be able to attract and maintain and keep NBA players if they ever started winning it.
How has the dysfunction between the three Hawks ownership groups hurt the Hawks on the court in the past?
Well, somebody has to be able to make a decision. The owner has to be able to say, yes, we're going to make this trade, or yes, we're going to sign this free agent. We're going to spend this amount of money. And when you have ownership groups that are fighting with one another, it becomes very difficult.
Let's turn to the team's success this season. You have written any number of Hawks players, Al Horford, Paul Millsap, Kyle Korver, Jeff Teague, could be all-stars, or none of them could. Is that what makes the Hawks so good, or does the lack of a superstar hurt their chances as a championship contender?
You know, we'll find out when they make the playoffs. I think this will be a great test to see if in an era where most teams are now trying to get two or three superstars to play together the way the Miami Heat did the previous four seasons, if a team full of good but not great players can beat one of those teams in the playoffs.
Hawks coach Mike Budenholzer spent more than 15 years as a San Antonio Spurs assistant before he came to Atlanta in 2013. Is he trying to turn the Hawks into the Spurs of the East?
Oh, there's no question. They're doing a great job with their assistant coaches, really developing the team extremely well. It's a no-nonsense group. They play defense. They share the ball. That's all the hallmarks of what the Spurs did. The only difference is the Spurs have Tim Duncan,
who's
the first ballot Hall of Famer, and the Hawks currently don't. So
fairly significant distinction.
Exactly.
The owners put the franchise up for sale this week. Majority owner Bruce Levinson had already announced that he would sell his stake after an email surfaced in which he complained about the lack of white fans at Hawks games. In a separate incident, general manager Danny Ferry made racist remarks on a conference call. Plenty of room for distraction. How has all of that affected the players?
You know, I don't think it has. If you look at their record, you certainly wouldn't think that it has. This is pretty much the same team that was there last season. So there wasn't a lot of turnover. There was no turnover in the coaching staff, certainly. So they know how to play with one another now. And, you know, last year, there wasn't the trust factor with one another that there is this year. And that comes from continuity and playing with each other for more than a year.
The NBA has announced that the Hawks will not be relocating after the team is sold, squelching rumors about Seattle getting the team. What traits would make for the best new ownership group in Atlanta?
Well, the NBA always wants one owner. They want one person to be in charge, to write the biggest check, and to have control. So if the team is going to stay in Atlanta, certainly someone with Atlanta roots or someone who has Atlanta affiliations through their businesses is someone that would be preferable. Other than that, the main thing is an owner who's willing to spend money to put more money than the sale price into the team, back into the team, and that's what they would want to see.
David Aldrich is an NBA analyst for TNT, and you can link to his story, Last Piece Hawks Need to Contend, Not Found on Court, at onlyagame.org. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It was a small item on page B9 of the New York edition of the New York Times. Wanted, better basketball for a weary reporter. Scott Cazziola is that weary reporter. His beat is the New York Knicks, a team that, at the time of the sports department editor's plea, had posted a dismal 5-32 record. Scott, could you please begin by describing what it's been like to cover the Knicks this season?
You know, it actually extends back to last season. Last season was my first year on the beat. The team was not very good. Missed the playoffs. And then they brought in Phil Jackson, obviously, to kind of overhaul the whole franchise. And he really wanted this season to be a showcase for his system and his philosophy to attract better free agents in the future. And it hasn't gone that way. You know, it's hard. I mean, it's hard for the reporters. It's hard for the players. It gets monotonous after a while. They're just not that talented. They've had a lot of injuries. It's the same story day after day, with the exception of some trades they've made. So it just gets tiring.
On Wednesday, the Knicks set a new franchise record for losing streak. That mark previously had stood at 12. But the final straw for your editors was this week's trade of guards J.R. Smith and Iman Shumpert. Am I right to assume that trade will not improve the team?
Not in the short run, Bill, that's for sure. I think it was a clear indication that Phil Jackson and the people who run the team are trying to build something in the years ahead. This season is kind of a lost cause. I think they all kind of recognize that. J.R. Smith had another year left on his contract after this season, and they wanted to get rid of it, so they did. They didn't get anything in return other than three players that they waived and then a second-round pick in 2019. Really, it was about just getting rid of salaries to clear room for the summer.
In Wednesday's paper, the sports editors declared that you will be getting a break from covering the Knicks for the next month or so. They say they'll send you to write about, quote, quality basketball instead. Are there any restrictions on what level of basketball you'll be covering?
Absolutely not, Bill. That's one of the great joys of this experiment. We've been soliciting suggestions from readers. A lot of readers have written in with great stuff. I mean, we've heard from people who have great stories about fifth grade teams, why their local rec league teams, games in the Canary Islands. So honestly, this is going to be a lot of fun for me. I feel guilty, actually, if I can disclose this, that I've sort of been sharing my Knicks duties this season with another reporter by the name of Andrew Kay, who does a great job. And sort of in my absence, he's going to be continuing to cover the Knicks. So I do feel guilty, and I kind of wish I could bring Andrew along with me.
I would think it being January in Nick's country, it'd be very nice to, say, relocate to Hawaii or the Canary Islands or someplace like that.
I pitched New Zealand, personally. I think there's a great tournament happening in a couple of weeks. We'll see if my editor goes for it, though.
And your former co-coverer of the Knicks, he will continue to cover the Knicks, a poor guy.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we ran that advertisement in the paper, it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek. They are giving me a break to pursue other stories, but we're not stopping covering the team. Even though the team is lousy, it's still important to a lot of people in the city, fans of the team. And even when a team is struggling, it's still newsworthy. So we're not abandoning coverage of the Knicks. We'll still be there for the news. But, you know, I think it is a way of sort of trying to be lighthearted about it, I guess.
Scott Cassiola covers the Knicks, or he used to cover the Knicks, for the New York Times, but for the next month or so, he'll be writing about basketball teams and players who are actually succeeding and playing well. Scott, thank you and good luck.
Thanks, Bill.
Clint Malarchuk caught and deflected pucks from 1985 through 1992 for the Quebec Nordiques, Washington Capitals, and the Buffalo Sabres. He also coached in both the minors and in the NHL. But most hockey fans know Malarchuk for one especially gruesome incident in 1989 when an opposing player's skate slashed his jugular vein, which required life-saving measures from an athletic trainer. Now, with the assistance of Dan Robson, Malarchuk has written A Matter of Inches, How I Survived in the Crease and Beyond. Clint Malarchuk, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, it's great to be on.
You contend in A Matter of Inches as follows. I basically willed myself into becoming an NHL goalie. Tell us a little about the obstacles you had to overcome by will to get to the NHL.
I didn't feel normal as a kid, let's put it that way. Later on, big anxiety, a lot of anxiety and things like that. And nothing was ever flat out said that I was diagnosed with a certain disorder or anything like that. But looking back now, as things happened and evolved in my life, I was certainly very much obsessive compulsive. And when I say I willed myself to be an NHL goaltender, I think that the OCD helped me make it to the NHL because of my obsession with training, with being the best that I could be. And it was very over the top. Usually 12-year-olds aren't doing quite that, even if they're aspiring to be an NHL hockey player.
You have been frank about your obsessive behavior and your anxiety since your retirement, and you're certainly candid about them in the book. How did you handle them while you were still playing in the National Hockey League?
Well, especially with goaltenders and superstitions, there's a lot of athletes that are that way, and especially goaltenders are kind of quirky, and it almost gives goalies a green light to behave any way they want. Because they're, oh, he's just a goalie, and that's okay. So people that suffer with obsessive compulsive disorder were great actors because we don't want anybody to know what we're going through and why we're doing certain things. So for me, my biggest thing was hiding all this stuff that was going on with me. So I became a normal functioning goaltender on the outside. People looking at me go, wow, you're the most normal goalie I've ever played with. I didn't try to act out in any way or superstitious before games or anything like that, because it was the OCD I was hiding.
The 1989 accident in which your throat was cut by a skate could have ended your life, never mind your career, but apparently you only realized how traumatic that incident had been many, many years after it had happened. Is that right?
Oh, that's bang on. After the accident, I did go through a lot of things, but I ended up being diagnosed with OCD then, because within that year or two after the accident, I really spiraled into a deep depression. The OCD became almost unbearable, where it was hard for me to leave the house. Definitely panic and anxiety at times. And once I got on the right medication and things really went good for a number of years, I kind of relapsed into a state of depression, and I ended up becoming suicidal and even attempted suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I still have a bullet lodged in my skull. I was in intensive care. I went to a treatment facility, and they worked on a lot of my issues. I was self-medicating with alcohol, so that was one of the issues. A counselor there suggested that I may have PTSD because of the accident in 1989. Now, this is all happening in 2008, and I wouldn't buy into it. By no means I was accepting the PTSD. I accepted depression, anxiety, OCD, severe anxiety. I didn't need any more initials, but I took the initials, PTSD, and started to work on that, learning so much about how trauma affects people. And now with our veterans coming back, we have 22 suicides a day by veterans. They survive the war, they come back and commit suicide because of PTSD. And I've heard some of them discuss their anger and their depression and anxiety, and I totally relate to that.
I have to ask whether after the injury and some of the aftermath, it ever occurred to you to seek another line of work?
Well, you know, hockey was what I lived for. It's what I did. And as a former athlete now, I mean, there's a lot of anxiety for players, especially if they haven't gone the college route to get some sort of education. I had nothing. I knew horses, and that was it. Hockey was my life.
The chapter entitled Lucky One includes these words: "This book wasn't easy to write. It took me back to a lot of places I never wanted to see again." And in fact, you write that you relapsed while you were working on it. Now that the book is out, do you feel that it was worth going back to those places?
Absolutely. People say, was it therapeutic to write? Not a chance. I had done so much therapy and put all this stuff behind me. And I went very deep. The book is described as raw. I wanted to help people. And unless I went to those places that I had been, it's not going to help people that are living in that place. And it was a hard project. I quit several times. I didn't want to do it. I always came back and pecked away at it, but the feedback that I'm getting is just so gratifying from PTS sufferers, their military, people just in regular life with OCD and depression, anxiety. I thought my purpose was to play in the NHL. And then after that, I thought my purpose was to coach in the NHL. Now I look and those were just stepping stones. Why was I given all these disorders? I feel my real purpose was to write the book and now to talk about it. And now I'm getting all sorts of feedback that it's helping people. And for me, that is just more fuel for me to go forward and speak.
Not surprisingly, the injury has gotten a lot of attention over the years. But I want to ask you to share a favorite memory from your days in the NHL, maybe a game that stands out for positive reasons.
Well, early in my career, I may have still been a rookie. I'm not sure because I bounced around for the first few years up and down from the minors. But I was able to, you're going to like this one, being out of Boston. I shut out the Boston Bruins in the Garden in Boston. And then we went back to Quebec. I was playing for the Quebec Nordiques at the time. And we had a home and home. So we go back and I shut them out again. And so I had back-to-back shutouts against the mighty Bruins, which as a kid, I admired them. So that was huge for me. My mom saw me play my first NHL game on the second shutout. She had flown into Quebec. So that was a very memorable time, especially because it was so early in my career.
Do you feel the National Hockey League is better equipped to deal with players who have emotional and psychological issues now than they were, say, 20 years ago?
I know firsthand that the NHL and the NHL Players Association is very, very concerned about their players and their former players. They've helped me immensely in my recovery and my healing. You know, if you've got a mental illness, you're not going to go to your boss just because of the stigma. And that, to me, is something where society, and not just the NHL, we have to get rid of the stigma so that people can get help.
The book includes a lot about your recovery, I should say recoveries, perhaps, through AA and various other means. How are things going for you now?
They're going really good. I mean, I've learned so much. I've tried and I've failed. And I've taken, two steps forward, one step back, two steps forward and five steps back. And now I'm at a place with experience and, help and support and doing a program daily. I have a regimen that I follow. It's, I have to work out. That helps me mentally. I have to do a 12-step program. I have to meditate. And some days are easy. I just go through just like I feel, wow, this is great. I feel normal. Some days are a little tougher, but I have tools now. And I'm not afraid to use them. I'm not afraid to reach out to people that understand these disorders and stay moderated.
With Dan Robson, Clint Malarchuk wrote A Matter of Inches, How I Survived in the Crease and Beyond. Clint, thank you very much for speaking with me, and good luck.
Thank you. This is a great interview. Thanks for having me.
If you would like to read an excerpt from Matter of Inches or my review of Same, please come on over to onlyagame.org. Coming up on Only a Game, the push to add adaptive bobsled to the Paralympic Games. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
For many, the big news from the long-awaited independent investigation into the NFL's punishment of Ray Rice was that no evidence was found to prove that Commissioner Roger Goodell had lied about seeing a video of Rice striking his then-fiancée. What was your takeaway from the Mueller report?
NFL investigation discovers NFL blameless on major count.
Shocked.
Film from 6 o'clock till 6:15. You know, I mean, and then the remarkable thing about this, of course, is that having at least demonstrated that the NFL under Roger Goodell, you know, makes Inspector Clouseau look like Hercule Poirot, or however you pronounce his last name, Poirot, is the fact that now what we have to do to make this all right is give Roger Goodell more power.
Of course.
This was an exercise in kabuki and should not be paid attention to.
After a botched pass interference call during last Sunday's playoff loss to the Dallas Cowboys, Detroit Lions coach Jim Caldwell wants to, quote, take the human element out of officiating in the NFL. Can you imagine a system in which that would be possible?
Damn right. I saw that call. And you know what? It's 6-5 and pick 'em whether or not those were actually humans refereeing the game. That was one of the worst calls, worst non-calls or calls or whatever you call it when they pick up the flag and don't tell you why, that I've ever seen in my life.
But still, can there be a mechanized version of officiating in the NFL? I mean, it's not like a mechanical strike zone in baseball.
No, but you can replay certain things and replay them closely.
Oh, okay.
And not be cowardly about having made the original call when everybody around you in the Dallas Stadium is howling for your blood. It was a terrible, terrible call. And while Detroit did not distinguish itself in the second half of that game in any way, it was a very unfortunate and an embarrassment to a league that prides itself at the very least on its efficiency.
The owner of the St. Louis Rams intends to build an 80,000-seat stadium near Los Angeles, and the governor of Missouri says he would like to see the Rams stay where they are in St. Louis. Who's going to win this battle?
I don't know, but let the guy build a stadium in Los Angeles, and if he wants to move his team, Missouri, let him move his team. The extortion is starting to get a little bit wild again. And I'm not entirely sure the NFL is too happy about this guy building his own stadium and moving his team to L.A. L.A. is much more valuable to the NFL as a whole as a threat than it is as a reality.
Florida State quarterback and 2013 Heisman winner Jameis Winston confirmed on Wednesday that his school days are over. Do you expect Winston to be an early pick in April's NFL draft, or will teams be a little skittish based on what he's done off the field?
I think considering that his accuser has filed a federal lawsuit against the school in regards to the alleged sexual assault, I think some NFL people will be skittish about it. I think he'll be a first-round pick, but I don't think he'll be the first quarterback taken.
Sometimes the Baseball Hall of Fame vote generates suspense, Charlie. This time around, perhaps not so much, at least with respect to Randy Johnson and Pedro Martinez. Am I right?
Yeah, both of them got 90% of the vote. I'm enormously happy. I'm very happy for Pedro. I don't feel particularly good for Randy Johnson one way or the other, but there has never been a more transformative and better athlete in Boston in my lifetime than Pedro Martinez, and I'm very happy with him. Craig Biggio, sure, why not? You know, John Smoltz, same thing. He's, you know, starter reliever. He and Eckersley can have something to talk about at the induction.
Meanwhile, Curt Schilling did not get into the Hall of Fame, and he announced this week that that was because he's a Republican. Are there no Republicans in the Hall?
There are all Republicans in the Hall! More to the point, he decided that Smoltz only got in, at least in part, because he was a Democrat. And he turns out that Smoltz is a Republican. Curt Schilling, my friend, going to the International Wingnut Grifters Hall of Fame for sure.
Boston will be the U.S. bidder for the 2024 Olympic Games. Bid Chairman John Fish says he is, quote, wicked excited about the prospect of an Olympics here, where only a game is produced. Are you?
Kill me now. Because I don't want to be around for this cataclysm.
We have 10 years.
Well, as we've talked about before the show, there are 2 and 3 levels of bribery to go through here
exactly. Before
we even come close to a decision. So I still have hope that somewhere international corruption will save us from ourselves.
Attempts to make the Cleveland Cavaliers a team worthy of King LeBron James have not yet resulted in a turnaround, but nobody can say the team isn't spending enough money, right?
Yeah, they're going to get hit for $6.7 million for the luxury tax for picking up 3 players, including 2 from the bag-faced victims of the New York Knicks. They're trying. I think that whole franchise is a little bit stunned by the fact that it hasn't turned around right away with the return of LeBron James.
Charlie, I thought perhaps...
I was hoping we were going to do this
that
story.
We had reached the bottom of the barrel with regard to all things Rob Gronkowski, but apparently I was absolutely wrong.
Yes, an author named Lacey Noonan has produced A Gronking to Remember, which is described on its cover, and this is something I never thought I'd be saying when I got into sports writing, book one in the Rob Gronkowski Erotica series. Now, Amazon has saved us all
from
absolutely having to buy A Gronking to Remember by pulling it off the Amazon website, because on the cover, there's a picture of Rob Gronkowski in his uniform with a patch commemorating Myra Kraft, the wife of Patriots owner Bob Kraft.
Mm-hmm.
While A Gronking to Remember is off the shelves, many of Ms. Noonan's, which by the way is not her real name, novels can still be found, including I Don't Care If My Best Friend's Mom Is a Sasquatch, She's Hot and I'm Taking a Shower with Her. And that's much too long a title. Among its other problems, that's much too long a title.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland. And, of course, he joins me each week here at Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
On Tuesday, John Smoltz learned that he'd be entering the Baseball Hall of Fame with fellow pitchers Randy Johnson and Pedro Martinez. He responded to the news with modesty.
I'm not in their class when it talks about the numbers that they put up, but I'm probably not in anyone's class because of the strangeness of my career and the uniqueness of what I did. So it kind of sets me apart a little bit.
Just a little bit. For 17 of his 21 years in the major league, Smoltz had no saves. But over the course of 4 years in the middle of that career, he had 154 of them. One season, he led the National League with 55. And, of course, he won 213 games as a starter. So, yes, his statistics set him apart. In a press conference following his election to the Hall, Randy Johnson talked at length about how unimpressive he'd been during the early part of his career and how grateful he was for the patience his various employers had displayed. Unlike Smoltz, who spent his entire career with Atlanta, Johnson pitched for six teams. Was he proud and happy to be going to Cooperstown? Yes, he was.
It was something 5 years ago people were talking to me about, and I put it off because 5 years just flew by. And now we're at this day where I got the call, and I'm so appreciative and honored. I never joined a fraternity in college, and now I'm amongst one of the coolest in the world.
During the 5 years since his retirement, Johnson has been around the world twice, visiting troops with the USO. He's developed what he calls a passionate interest in photography. In short, he has, as he says, removed himself from baseball. But this week, the memories flooded back.
I remember putting tape on my wooden garage door, and I would throw in this little tape box. That was my strike zone, and I was Vita Blue with a tennis ball. Well, after about a half an hour, my dad would come out, and he would have a hammer in his hand, and he would say, "You make sure you pound all those nails back in the garage door."
Like Randy Johnson and John Smoltz, fellow electee Pedro Martinez had some spectacularly successful seasons. In 1999, he won 23 games while losing just four, and his earned run average was 2.07. The next season, it was an otherworldly 1.74. Over 18 seasons, Martinez won 219 games and lost just 100. When a reporter mentioned that he was one of only 50 players to be elected to the Hall in his first year of eligibility, Martinez seemed surprised.
Thank you for the info.
You're welcome.
I didn't know that. It's humbling and a great honor to become part of history.
History was also on the mind of ESPN's Tim Kirkchin this week. He puts Martinez and Johnson in some exceptional company, even by Hall of Fame standards.
You could certainly make a case that this is the first time since Walter Johnson and Christy Mathewson went in 1936 that two pitchers of this ilk have gone in at the same time. So to me, it was historic. Certainly one of the four or five best classes in baseball history.
The only non-pitcher to make the cut this time around was Craig Biggio, who spent his entire 20-year career with the Houston Astros. He accumulated 3,060 hits. Still, until Tuesday, he didn't assume he'd be elected to the Hall of Fame.
I didn't take it for granted. So, yeah, it was a very emotional phone call when I received the news, and humbling. Like I said, I just love playing the game of baseball and every minute of it, every inning of it.
Tim Kirkjian, on the other hand, feels Biggio probably should have anticipated the honor he received.
He had more doubles than Hank Aaron. He had more extra base hits than Mickey Mantle. He reached base 4,500 times. Only 18 players have done that, and they're all in the Hall of Fame except for Barry Bonds, Pete Rose, and Derek Jeter. He got hit by a pitch more times than anyone in modern baseball history, and he went an entire year without grounding into a double play once. Those are the little numbers that really make his value even greater than you think.
The induction ceremonies for John Smoltz, Randy Johnson, Pedro Martinez, and Craig Biggio will be held in Cooperstown on July 26th. A Wichita native is hoping to pave the way for other disabled athletes by driving an adaptive bobsled in the 2018 Winter Paralympics. There's only one problem. Adaptive bobsled is not yet an official Paralympic sport. But according to some, it's only a matter of time. Abigail Wilson of KMUW in Wichita has more.
He's a lifelong athlete with a love for competition. At Wichita's campus high school, he quarterbacked the football team and played outfield on the baseball team. But in April 2008, during Lance Roop's junior year, that came to an end.
I was in a car accident. Yep, I was on my way to school. I was driving. Last thing in my head thinking, why didn't I listen to the radio? I just got my radio fixed, you know, and I looked up and I thought I saw something running out of the ditch. It ended up being a dog, actually, and it just startled me. I just grabbed the wheel, went spinning, and ended up paralyzed.
Roop was paralyzed from the chest down. Now at 23, he's a sophomore at the University of Central Oklahoma, where he plays wheelchair basketball and is on the wheelchair track team. But he says those sports aren't competitive enough for him. So last fall, he went online and found a form for people interested in becoming Paralympians. The form listed all of the official Paralympic sports, like wheelchair curling and alpine skiing.
I just checked every single one and ended up getting a call about bobsledding.
The call was from Dave Nichols, director of the United States Adaptive Bobsled and Skeleton Association, or USABSA. He asked Lance to come try his luck at bobsledding. Nichols is also a paraplegic and a bobsledding pioneer.
Approximately 10 years ago, I was invited up to the Olympic Park as one of four disabled athletes to kind of be guinea pigs, if you will, and participate in driving the first adaptive sled that ever existed.
So what exactly is an adaptive bobsled? It looks just like the traditional two-man bobsled, but with a roll cage on top, like you would see on a go-kart. It also has a four-part harness that holds the driver in the sled.
Because when you're hitting 4 or 5 Gs at 70, 80, 90 miles an hour, and the sled is up on its side, if you don't have the physical strength or ability, which some of these guys don't have, and they need the four-part harness system to hold them secure in their seat.
Nichols says the USABSA is the main force in the United States in promoting, recruiting, and fundraising for adaptive bobsled. And while huge strides are being made in the sport, they have yet to reach all of the qualifications set by the International Paralympic Committee, or IPC, that would make it an official Paralympic sport. Nichols says he thinks bobsled could be a full medal sport in the Paralympic Games in the near future.
Even though the USABSA, with all our athletes, has been rallying the troops, if you will, and doing this for the past 10 years, it's only really within the past 3 years that the international governing body of the sport, the FIBT, has taken us seriously as disabled athletes and taken the challenge to meet all this criteria that the IPC requires. So we're well on our way. The word on the street is at the very least will be a exhibition sport in the 2018 Pyeongchang Winter Olympics.
And that's good news for rookie bobsledder Lance Roop, who has his sights set on competing in 2018, even though he's fairly new to the sport.
I can still remember the whole track right now. You know, you start left, right, straight away, circle, left, right. It's pretty fun, you know. I like it a lot, I guess. I mean, I've only done 5 times, and I've crashed 2 out of the 5 times, but yeah, I still made the team, so that's all that matters.
Roop's sled training began in November in Calgary on the track used in the 1988 Winter Olympics. His responsibilities as the driver include transferring himself from his wheelchair into the bobsled, which must be done in a minute or less. After lifting himself out of his wheelchair and onto the roll cage, Roop scoots forward and down into the sled. Roop says he takes off his tennis shoes to make that easier. He stows them in the sled next to his thighs. I ask him if his feet get cold.
No, you'd think they would, but you know, that's a good thing about not being able to feel them, I guess.
Roop's first run in a bobsled was in Calgary in November. He describes the experience of going down the track as nuts.
I made it to the bottom, and I made it down there pretty fast, and we were shiny side down, which is our heads up and not on the side.
That run was one of the safer ones. The next time down, he crashed.
When we crashed, they actually forgot to pin my roll cage, so I came out a little bit and ended up blacking my eye a little bit, but it wasn't too bad. You know, you just hold on and ride it out, and pretty soon you're at the bottom, and someone's with big old eyes asking you you're okay, and you say yeah, and you get out, and you go back down again.
He says the speed, the excitement, and the potential danger help him forget he's a paraplegic.
In the bobsled going down, it's unexplainable, really. I mean, you're really not thinking about anything besides getting down there, getting to the bottom, you know what I mean? The whole thought of the fact that I'm paralyzed and the fact that the guy behind me is an amputee, you know, missing a leg or whatever, is just totally out of my mind. It's all about getting down there safe. You know, you're going so fast.
Roop says he plans on making bobsledding and wheelchair athletics a big part of his future through continued training and fundraising. He will be in Austria and then Switzerland next week to attend additional driving schools. If he does well there, he could be one of three athletes chosen to represent the United States in the first ever World Cup for Paralympic bobsled at the FIBT Parasport Official World Cup in Eaglis, Austria, which runs from January 17th through the 24th.
We're running with it, you know, and this being inventors of the sport, and we kind of take a lot of pride in it, so we like to go over to Europe and show them what we're about.
For Only a Game, I'm Abigail Wilson.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is James Trout. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Ashlock, Michael Garth, from Andrew at KUNR in Reno, and from Mark Moran and Jimmy Jenkins at KJZZ in Phoenix. Welcome to our new intern, Keely Flanagan. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from Clint Malarchuk, whose choice of morning beverage is clear and unequivocal.
I'm a coffee guy. I have a pot and a half in the morning.
Well, as long as you cut it out by 10 a.m., probably you still can get to sleep. I'm Bill Littlefield. Happy New Year. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.